Hi, I'm Monse, and this is Musings of the Artist, a podcast where I have meaningful conversations with all kinds of artists. Michael Kleber Diggs is a poet, essayist, and literary critic. His debut poetry collection, Worldly Things, was published last year, and he is also a contributor to the book There's a Revolution Outside My Love, Letters from a Crisis. Michael teaches creative writing through the Minnesota Prison Writing Workshop and at colleges and high schools in Minnesota. In this conversation, Michael and I discuss his writing story, hope and sorrow, the power of mentorship to change a life, and more. I love this conversation so much, and I'm thrilled to share it. Thank you again, Michael. I'm so excited to dive into this conversation with you. As I mentioned, I've been deep in your words, your beautiful, powerful book, and your essays, and then just reading and listening to your interviews has been such a delight these last few days and weeks. And I also want to say how much I enjoy your website. Oh. It's so fun. You have your animals on there, which I really love.
Yes,
it's just delightful. So,
Well, thanks for saying that, and thanks for having me.
Absolutely.
And it's funny because I have some shyness about my website. I always want it to be a little, I don't know, jazzier or high tech. But I love. We have two dogs and two cats, and I was working with a friend to get the content on there with a bit more sophistication than I could manage on my own. And she had the idea to add them. And I just thought, yes. Yeah, that's such a good idea.
Oh my gosh. And I think you should be proud of it because I see so many websites. I've always going to artist websites. And I think we have this like thing where we feel like we need to be so like you said, sort of like buttoned up and present this like side to us, right? But what I loved about your website was that, I mean, of course, we have all that on there, like the serious parts and the, but there's like you feel your personality come through, and I think that's so rare, and I love that.
Well, thanks, and I you know, I have a little joke in there, like I think, 12 truths and one lie.
Yes, so just, good.
Yeah, and I do care, of course, and this is what I do for a living and how I present myself to the world matters a lot. And I also want to be the same character that I kind of always am. And I gravitate toward levity and silliness and I wanted to show that side of myself too.
Yeah. Well, I for one very much appreciated it. So, I normally like to start the podcast conversations with a big question. And I have this printout of the Poets and Writers magazine interview that you did, which I just was filled with just gems, and I highlighted like almost all of it. so I want to talk to you about a lot of this, and one of the things that you talk about in this piece is having a difficulty claiming the title of poet, or having had that for a while. And I definitely want to dive deep into that. But before we do, you know, of course, the way that I found you was through your work as a poet. So I would love to start by asking you this big question is, you know, how would you start to describe yourself beyond that title, beyond what you do and how people know you?
That is a big question. It's almost difficult not to begin with the roles that define me. Hmm. Chief among them would be father. I, when I was young, I really wanted to be a dad, and I of course had not much of a sense for what that actually meant. And when I became a dad, I learned a lot, not only about what it means to be a parent, but also about myself as a parent. I am a writer, as you noted. I write poems and essays, as you shared. Outside of that, I think of myself as someone who's really disoriented toward community. trying to figure out how to be empathetic and how to be authentic in my relationships and practice an intimacy that's simultaneously complete and respectful. I think that's really how I see myself and what I value and what's important to me.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, thank you for sharing that. Definitely see all that. You know, one thing you just sort of touched on was something that just really struck me while reading all of your work and learning a bit more about you as a person is that you strike me as somebody who, you know, you're writing about very difficult topics and heartbreaking things, and yet you write with such tenderness. And there's this feeling in all of your work to me of hope. You know, even like amidst all this heaviness. And this is another big question to start with, but I just wanted to ask you about this because, you know, in my life, I have found that the people that have gone through the depths of sorrow and just really difficult things almost always, you know, are the ones who are the ones with the most hope and kindness. And I'm always sort of curious about that. And, you know, I'm wondering if it's something that you've really worked to cultivate, because, you know, we didn't mention this, but you had a very tragic loss early on in your life. When you were 8, you lost your father. And of course, all the other things in your life. And I'm just curious if like that is something you worked to cultivate, this hope and this optimism, because it does seem like you do hold that side by side with all the difficulties in your life that you've had experienced. Does that question make sense? And
does. No, 100%. And I think the only way I can respond to your big question is with a big answer. Mm. And the answer is I'm not sure. Mm. I have acquired it. That I can say with confidence. Whether I cultivated it, it's harder to know. So as you pointed out, my father was killed. My father was a crime victim when I was 8 years old. Which is a shocking event at any time in your life. But at 8, it's a really, I think, interesting time developmentally. I didn't really know my father. I certainly knew a lot about what he was like, but I didn't really know him as a person. He was a parent and he was godlike in a way to me. At the point that he died, I did not have a sense of what that meant. Certainly, I did not have the same sense of what that meant that I have now. I knew that I would never see my father again, and that was basically the only way that I could understand it. How it affected me, what it would mean for the rest of my life. So, for example, every graduation, at my wedding, when my daughter was born, that loss, the magnitude of it was not something that I could consider when I was 8. And so it has revealed itself to me over time. There is no question that I was affected profoundly by that event. I know that I left it or entered it with a real sense that we are fragile. That at any moment, someone that you love, and for me at that point, need, can be taken away. And I think that the way that that fragility resides in me is with a sense of how precious our lives are. I feel philosophical right now, but that's really kind of the only way that I can frame it. I feel like I'm only going to be here a short time. My father was 36 when he died, and I'm 53 as I talk to you right now. And I distinctly remember when I turned 36, you know, I've outlived my father and how young I felt at that time. And our time here is so short, and I don't want to give you the sense that I'm some superhuman that squeezes every ounce of joy out of every day. That's not true. Like all the things, lazy, and I don't appreciate everything at the time that I'm seeing it, but I do have, I think, a heightened sense of how short our time is here.
Yeah.
And in light of that, it shapes a lot of how I think about other people, about time with them, time doing things that I love and enjoy. It's left me hopeful.
Yeah.
For lack of an alternative, I honestly think, but I do try to gravitate toward things that validate and reassure and remind us of how difficult it is here, but also how beautiful.
Yeah. Yeah. Thank you for sharing that. You know, that last poem in your book, World of Things, which really broke my heart. That to me was also sort of in the vein of what we're talking about. It just, you know, it sort of spurred this question in me of like, how does one, when you have this, you carry this openness throughout the world and, you know, you feel like you get shut down by different people when you have this openness, like, how do you keep going after you get hurt over and over and over again like that, you know, and how do you continue to keep that light? And I don't know, I think you and your work, you really are a beautiful example of that. So just thank you for being you.
Well, and thanks for sharing that. The last poem of the book is called Every Morning. And as you know, in that poem, I'm walking around my neighborhood, just a morning walk. And I encounter another person who's concerned about me, which is something that kind of happens from time to time. And I spend some time in that poem guessing why that might be.
Yeah.
Is it about my gender? Is it about my race? Is it about my size? What's causing this? And I take care not, well, I want the listener in that poem to be with me as I conjecture, like, what's causing this?
Yeah.
And I hope that my wondering is an effort toward understanding.
Yeah.
That I can't know for certain. I do know that at the end of the poem, I'm desperate for something different, which is not about the person that I run into. And it's not even about me. It's about us. And our time together and these misconnections and these misunderstandings and the absence of connection and how that affects us.
Yeah. 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 I thought it was really powerful to put this poem at the very end because it just sits in you, you know, and at least for me it did. It just,
Well, thank you.
Yeah. I wanted to touch on something you were talking about your father. And before we move on from that, I think I either heard or read in an interview where you were speaking about that it took you a long time to actually write about your father, that you had been sort of avoiding, if I'm remembering this correctly, that you were sort of not talking, you know, writing about him. And that really struck me because, you know, I was curious because I think that all of us who write, you know, we always have these like these big themes that we circle around in our writing. And I find that sometimes we are writing about something that we don't even know we're writing about. And, you know, like I was talking to, I'm in a MFA program right now, and I was talking to my advisor recently about this, about, you know, she had been sexually assaulted by her father. And, you know, she was telling me how in, we were talking about all her different books and how, you know, there are a couple of her books that she doesn't even mention her father, but of course they are about him, you know, in this way. And and of course I've experienced that as myself as a writer too, where I'm like not writing about the thing that is a trauma from the past, but I am writing about it. So long-winded way to ask you, I was just curious if you thought about that, like if you, in your earlier writing, when you were avoiding the topic of writing about this deep pain and loss, if you feel like you were writing about it in other ways.
Sure.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I have to tell you, I had not really considered it until just now, like 15 seconds ago when you asked me. I mean, it shapes my obsessions for sure. And, you know, I write toward captivation. That's my main poetry practice is there's, I see something, I hear something, I witness something, I read something, and I'm captivated by it. And I just want to spin it around.
Yeah.
And play with it in sound and meter. And if I look back on the poems that I wrote before I got to the poem where I'm like, oh, wow, my dad is here. Fully here. My father's death is here. In the drafting of a poem where I started off writing about squirt guns, I suddenly find my father is there. And that I was not expecting that to arrive. And I remember sitting at my desk thinking, okay, so are we gonna go into this room, or are we just gonna avoid it? If I look at the poems that I wrote before that, you know, and they kind of run the gamut, but there are a lot of themes that come up. And one of them is, I'll give you one that's kind of abstract and one that's kind of a little bit more direct. In an abstract way, I'm just obsessed with community and empathy and connection and honoring each other while we're here, maximizing moments, that type of thing, loving your neighbor. You know, so much of what divides us just seems silly in the grand scheme of things. It seems silly in the weight of what awaits us.
Yeah.
So I would write about empathy and community. Those themes are just so present in my work, which I really think is connected to that. And I also would write a lot about being underwater.
Oh, wow.
You know, if I think about it, and interestingly, I'm just beginning to think about a project right now where I want to write about grief and memory, and other topics connected to water and swimming and, you know, large bodies of water and how they're kind of all around us, like accessible and also mysterious.
Yeah.
And how that provides a frame for me to think about a lot of things that are kind of important to me. This is a super long answer to your question.
No, I'm loving it.
Which is yes. I was writing about that. And just not really realizing it until it became conspicuous.
Right. And you're a master of metaphor too, I gotta say. You're talking about the water. I was like, yes.
I don't know that I'm the first person to come up with that, but I think it does allow. I do hope that in my thinking about it, I will find something new, if not overall for myself and for how I think about things that matter to me.
Yeah. Thank you. I wanted to talk about the fact, so I was just reading the blurbs about your book and just like what caught my attention was Tracy K. Smith saying, what were her exact words? Now I'm forgetting. About being it being shocking that this is your debut. And I felt the same way. I'm sure everyone who read this is like, how is this writer not been out there already? You know, it's like incredible work. I wanted to talk to you about this because, you know, you're in the Poets and Writers feature. It's you're under this umbrella of 5 over 50, which I will say I deeply appreciate that they're doing that versus like, you know, 30 under 30. But at the same time, I just can't wait till I just wish that we didn't have to have these lists at all. You know what I mean? Doesn't matter what age people are, just like not worry about that. but I wanted to ask you about this because it was something that you brought up here. And I think as artists, as writers, it is, you know, because it's so discussed in our society, it's something that like becomes a preoccupation of ours. Is that the right word? Am I?
I think so.
Okay. Sure. You know, it's something that we feel is like outside pressure to you know, have this success or to make our mark in some little way, even at a young age. And I just, I think I've been talking about this a lot on the podcast lately, so people are probably like, all right, we get it already, like, let's move on. But I really wanted to talk about this with you because you do mention this, and you say at the end that you learned that it was never too old, you're never too old to be a young writer. And I just, that expanded my heart in, like, you know, 10 sizes. And I just wish that we could all, like, feel that, you know, and really get that. And this is a very long-winded way of asking you this question, but I just wanted to ask you about your journey as a writer. And, you know, just maybe you could talk a little bit about that and sure. how you came, because your poetry book is coming out in your early 50s. And so, and you're talking about this topic. And so I'm wondering if, like, how you have felt about that along the path, and if you felt this outside pressure that I'm talking about that is so annoying to try to get things out there just because of some societal pressure.
Yeah.
That was a very inarticulate way of asking that.
But I'm with you. I'm so with you. So I would say, in answer to the very last question, no.
Yeah.
That I've had the great good fortune of not being connected to the societal pressure to publish quickly, to publish in the right place, to feel myself in competition with or comparable to a cohort that I went to graduate school with. And I've felt very, very lucky because I'm writing in many respects outside of the academy. I'm writing in a community here in the Twin Cities, Minneapolis and St. Paul, that by my experience has been very generous, and I'm surrounded by people who are inquisitive and talented and doing incredible things. And I learned a lot from them. Speaking specifically about poetry, I probably started writing just, I love to write. I'm going to write something when I was in fourth grade.
Hmm.
And it's something that I've been in touch with on and off throughout my life. But just before I turned 30, I really started to take an interest in poetry. And I met Karen Kleber, who's now Karen Kleber Diggs.
Mm.
And when I met her, I was Michael Diggs, and now I am Michael Kleber Diggs. And for Christmas in the year 1999, she gave me a gift certificate to the Loft Literary Center, which is a really outstanding institution for, you know, promoting writers and readers and bringing them into community with each other here in the Twin Cities. And I wanted to take a short story class, if I remember correctly, but the schedule didn't work. So I took a poetry class, which was wonderful to me because I was also really starting to love poetry. And in that class, I met the teacher, Juliet Patterson, who's a poet I admire a tremendous amount. And after the class, she asked me to kind of continue to study with her as part of a small group of people that she taught privately.
Hmm.
And I said yes. And I worked with her as part of that small group for a total of 12 years.
Wow.
Which, when I think about the size of that gift, I am struck dumb. I don't have words. I can't think of anything to say that would express well how I feel about that.
Mm.
So I learned craft and theory and art with Juliet. I learned about poets. It might have taken me quite a bit longer to encounter because she suggested that we read them as a group. And through her, I started to learn about poetry and what it takes to do that. So the one thing I want to share just in reaction to what you wrote is I'm 53. I don't really feel all that old, although sometimes and in certain bones, I do.
Like, for sure. Is just not old either. I mean,
no, I know.
Like, you know, people are like, I don't know. I'm turning 40 this year and people are already making me feel like that's old. I'm like, come on.
Yeah, it's not. It just absolutely isn't. So, and I've been writing poetry in earnest kind of since 2000. I did take a few years off when my daughter was born. So I've been at it, let's say 15, 16 years. And, you know, at some point around year 12, I reached that level of knowledge where you understand how little, you know. And so when it comes to being a poet, I do feel young. I feel like I'm beginning to understand what's possible in the art, where my voice can reside within it, all the different ways it can show up, all the different ways it's being written and read today. And I'm so excited. Like I vibrate with excitement for the learning that I have yet to do.
Yes.
If I could have one writing related wish, this is what I would choose. That however long I live, the day I make my way, I will have written something. That prospect, the idea of that is just completely fascinating to me. And especially that my voice, my mind, my work will change as I change.
Yeah.
And how exciting that is too. So I feel new in poetry. I feel that I have acquired, you know, about the amount of wisdom a 53-year-old person would acquire, you know, with the days, maybe a little bit more than some. I know for sure less than others. And so I feel like a person who has something to talk about and to write about, who's learning some of the ways that can be done.
Yeah, that's so beautifully said. And I, as you were speaking this, I was thinking too about how, you know, if you take away that noise of other people saying, oh, you know, this, and I think part of it is also seeing reflected in other people, their anxiety about trying to get something out by a certain age, right?
Yeah.
It's not, and like it's kind of being put on you in a way. But I think these things like are this, the gift, the way you're speaking about writing and what it means to you, you know, as I think these things come to us at the time they're meant to come to us. And, I guess what I'm saying by that is, or thinking about that is like, you know, I didn't come into writing, like really come into it, because I didn't even dream about it. I didn't know that it could be something that I could really do. Like I just somehow thought it was like out there and like something I couldn't do. But I'm going to be 40 this year. And I just really started seriously writing, you know. What I mean by seriously is like actually like making this a practice and giving myself permission to like put these fully formed sentences into pieces. And, you know, I feel just like you when you're saying this energy that it has, that you're just like, oh my, it's like, you're almost like overtaken by it. And I was just sort of thinking about how, you know what, if I started this 20 years ago, I come to it now with all these, this life experience and these things that make it, you know, as powerful as it is because of that life experience and because of these things I collected along the way. So I don't know, when you're speaking about that, it made me think that, like, you know, it's not like we've lost something, you know, not having come to it earlier. I think it's just, it arrived when it was supposed to arrive.
I agree with that. And, you know, I know poets and writers half my age who are further along,
right,
as I see it, both as writers and as observers. And so you mentioned it earlier, we would do well to just take age out of it.
Yeah, totally. Please.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's my great wish. It's just like,
I also really connect to what you were sharing about becoming a writer late in life. You know, I had a hard time claiming the role poet. I really did. And there's so much about that, and race is a part of it, and curriculum is a part of it, and how I was raised is a part of it. I was raised mostly by my mother after my father died, and I grew up in a home where I had everything I needed and most of what I wanted, which is good luck. I was not spoiled, and I never knew want or worry about money and things like that. And that I'm grateful for that and for the sacrifices my mother made. I knew pretty much as long as I knew what college was that I was going to go. And I did. And education was a value in our house. And at the same time, the professions were exalted. So the message was go to college, get a degree, but be a doctor, be a lawyer, be an architect, be an accountant, get a business degree and do well with it. If you're going to go into something like the humanities, you have to get a PhD and be a professor. Mm. Be a leader in the community and affect change in that way. And also don't struggle and provide for your children and keep it going. And when I went to college, you know, if I look back on the number of Black teachers I had in my entire academic career, it's shockingly low. It's definitely less than 10. And I went to graduate school, through graduate school. And if I think about the number of books that I was assigned that were written by women, that were written by people of color, that were written by Black people, that number is also shockingly low. And it's not that I didn't know Black writers existed. I grew up in a home with books. I grew up with access to artists and poetry and Black writers and all of those things. And I just felt it was something only superhuman people could do, superhuman genius people could do. And I did not count myself among them. It never occurred to me that I could be a writer, that I could make a living as one. So I came to it late. And quite frankly, it was there the entire time.
Yeah.
Like I always did it. I always loved it. I imagined it as a passion and not as a vocation.
Right. Landing where you are now, where you're like, you are a published author and having the success and having people, you know, receive your work so with such, you know, admiration. And does this feel like a big sigh, like letting out a big sigh, kind of like, oh, how does that, I'm just wondering how that feels after all these years of not allowing yourself that.
Oh, this reminds me of something I was going to tell you earlier and kind of forgot to say. Yeah. I definitely did not feel pressure to publish. Like, I got to have a book in any external way, but internally. At some point, I realized that in a way, what I was doing is trying to have some artifact to survive my time here on Earth. This is classic midlife crisis behavior. Like, I probably could get a Corvette, but it would create so much concern in the home that I wouldn't even really consider it. So instead I'm like, this will survive my time here. People can refer back to it even after I'm gone. And it will in some ways express how I felt about things, how I saw the world, what my life was like, what my upbringing was like, just a little bit. Right. Yeah. I did have that kind of urgency, but having written one book, and if someone said, hey, Michael, just FYI, this is going to be it for you. This is the book. I would be completely content.
Yeah.
I would keep writing because I can't, I love it. And I kind of can't help it, but I would be fine with that. And I don't know that I've felt kind of that kind of, oh, thank goodness, moment yet. I have been so surprised by almost every aspect of this process. I was standing in my front yard. I'm looking over at the spot right now with my dogs when the phone rang, and it was Milkweed Editions, and I heard what they said. I understood every word, and yet I couldn't receive it. I couldn't. Wow. And then when the book arrived in the mail, and I knew it was coming. I knew it was coming. I couldn't believe that either. And when Tracy K. Smith and Sean Hill and poets I admire so much, like Camille Dungy, offered to share a thought for the book, that blew me away. When Henri Cole selected it, that blew me away. That it's been purchased, that it's been read, that people sometimes take a moment to send a note to say, I really, that poem or this book meant a lot to me. I'm blown away by all of it. Mm. All of it. Mm. Every time.
Mm. Like, there's the tenderness again. I just feel so much from you. It's such a pure, pure gratitude, I think. And it's so refreshing to hear someone with that, you know, it's
right.
It's not as common as you would think, I think. Lastly, sort of on this topic, you know, one of the things in this, I keep referring back to this piece because it's right in front of my face. but it says, you said, I try to send work where I want to see a place and ignore imaginary prerequisites, which I thought was another, thunderous sort of, important note, because again, back to this thing of, just sort of quality over the quantity thing, you know, yeah. Like making sure that you're just being true to yourself and like, yeah. You know, so anyways, I don't know if you want to say anything else about that.
I do. Sure. Yeah, great. Sure. I mean, would I love to have a poem in Poetry? Yes. In a New Yorker? Yes. In a Paris Review? Yes. Can you, all of it? Sure. And my interest there would be in sharing this thing I made with as many people as possible. I spoke earlier about being outside of the academy. I'm not trying to make tenure somewhere. I'm not trying to get a job at a university. I have, it's so hard to express it well. I have the luxury of being able to kind of just do what I want. And it would feel like squandering in a way. If what I did was what I felt I was expected to do.
Yeah.
If I see a journal and it looks really cool and I like what they're making, I kind of want to work with them. And when I sent this manuscript out, I kind of set my intentions. I kind of manifested this wish. And what I wished for was that it would land with a publisher who would interrogate the manuscript toward its improvement, that I would have an editor who would look at it, who would share feedback, and that I would benefit from that process.
Mm-hmm.
That I would work with a group that makes beautiful books, that I would enjoy the people that I worked with, that we would all be proud of the end product, that we would feel good about the process of working together, that we would like the book that resulted from our efforts, and feel good about it. I also, by the way, the fifth one is actually the first one, which is that I wanted to have a physical object at the end.
Oh, yeah.
A tangible thing. And what you'll notice is not on that list is, you know, I want to be published by Farrar Straus. And right. Don't get me wrong, that would be really awesome. But for where I was, I really just wanted to focus on other things. What really matters to me? And by me, I mean Michael, not anybody else. What do I want? What do I feel like would be really great? And I ended up with a dream publisher, with a phenomenal team, with a book that I am amazed by. It's beautiful as an object. It's beautiful. And I didn't have much to do with that part of it. And every other thing I asked for on top of it. Yeah. Wow. So I don't plan on going back. I just want to keep doing what I want to do.
Oh, thank you so much for sharing that. That's just so inspiring. And I'm just curious, this might sound like a weird thing to ask, but you were just describing these things that you sort of manifested and put forth. Was that like a physical thing that you like actually wrote it down? You did?
Yes. Yeah.
I love that. I love those stories because I've also had that experience. It's been a minute since like I've really had that, but the feeling when you like actually set these intentions and then it comes is like no other, you know?
Right. Yeah.
It feels like something just otherworldly, you know? Just like, wow.
It does.
Yeah. Yeah. So thank you for sharing that with us.
Yeah. My pleasure.
I want to talk to you about community because, as you were mentioning, it's such a key part of who you are and your work and all that. So two parts of this. One is mentorship, as I mentioned, or as you mentioned, rather, Juliet Patterson and the profound impact that she had on your life and your creative life. So this is sort of an open-ended question, but could you talk to me a little bit about, you know, creative mentorship and the role, that role in your life, maybe, you know, as well, however you want to, I don't want to put parameters around it, however you want to just talk about that.
Yeah. I want to talk about it in both ways.
Great.
For me, this is a point of fact. I would not be the writer I am today without a strong mentor. I think that I would be a poet still. I think I would write poems still. I think that I would make discoveries. And when I look at the early poems I've written, the writer I am today is present there as well. And, you know, I think early on, before we take on training, we write on instinct.
Yeah.
And I think a lot of times our instincts serve us. They're shaped by language, by reading, by listening, by arts that we have access to. And to the extent that we're doing any replication, it's probably rooted in something that's pretty solid. But I would not be a writer, the writer I am today, without Juliet Patterson. She kind of bristles when I say it. But for me, it's an argument that I would take up to my last breath. Her gift to me and to others is so vast, so selfless, so generous. It's kind of difficult to see myself as a writer of any kind without that giant blessing.
Wow.
What I try to do and fall short all the time is to be that person in the community, to be as generous to others as Juliet was for me. I'm not as good at it. I'm a work in progress there. I teach at an arts high school right now and in Minnesota Correctional Facilities. And from time to time, I'm invited to teach as an adjunct at universities here in the Twin Cities. I have friends who ask if I'll share ideas, and I really try to do that as I can. But to have a mentor meant a lot to me. To be a mentor means a lot to me. It's humbling. It's I feel really lucky that I have anything to offer at all. I feel grateful for that time in collaboration with someone else, for an opportunity to share ideas and to work together on things. I am a poetry group person.
Yeah.
And a creative nonfiction group person. And I find so much benefit in getting time to other people's insights and ideas and to sharing them, forming the way of sharing opportunities when I see it in other people's work. I also hope that outside of the arts, that way of being will frame who I am in the community overall. I want to stress, I'm a human being with shortcomings. I don't always live out my ideals. But when I think about the person I want to be, and when I think about the person I try to be, it looks a lot like the mentors who were so generous with their time and ideas when I was trying to figure it out, as I am now.
Yeah. Wow. I'm just like, ooh, awestruck by all that. I think it's touching. It's really striking a chord within me because I understand exactly what you're saying. I've had the great fortune of having mentors in my life that I'm blown away by the generosity of it. And I think that's why it's so important for me to talk about it too. And I'm just so excited that you are all equally as excited to talk about it. Because I mean, you know, you were talking about sort of, you were given this huge gift. And so in turn, you want to give that gift to others. And just like everything in life, right? Like that's sort of like this trickling effect. And I think about in my personal life, you know, early on I worked in the music industry for many, many years, and the way I still do because I teach in music. But I had this boss slash mentor at Sony Music who was like incredibly busy, but yet she carved out an hour every other day of the week. I started out as an intern there to do a lesson of the day. Mm-hmm. And she would teach us, me and another intern, something about the music business. And she did not need to do that, but it completely just changed me and so many ways. And even the act of her generosity is what changed me too. And I remember, years later when I was a manager, and I managed a team, I did the same thing. And I would have never have thought to do that if I hadn't been shown that,
Right.
So it's just like what you were saying really strikes a chord, because it's like, yeah, I mean, it's not only when these people are giving us this gift, they're giving it sort of to a lot of people because we want to pass it on,
Yeah.
I
was working on a poem recently. It's called Holocene Fruits. So it's about this epoch in time, the time of the Homo sapiens, and that allowed me to have a conversation about climate change. And that idea, climate change, was what brought me into the poem. Mm. You're like, Michael, what does this have to do with mentorship?
No, I'm in. Okay. I'm listening.
And then I found myself writing about the pandemic also. And I had a line in the poem, something along like, I was thinking about moments when I could forget about climate change and I could forget about the pandemic, and how those were typically disrupted by a realization that our best defense against these kinds of calamities is selflessness, thinking of others. And then I said in the poem, which means we're probably doomed, because we have this tendency to, I should say it differently. There are so many, it appears to me, among us now, who are concerned not just primarily with themselves, but almost exclusively.
Yeah.
I can find myself like over and over and over blown away that people can't make the next step. It's not, the mask protects you, yes, but it also prevents you from hurting other people.
And blows my mind.
Yeah, what brings all this up to me is your the manager that you worked with when you were in the music industry.
Yeah.
It's I have like the ability to share things with other people or to offer a benefit to someone else. One of the things I think that is the most amazing about mentorship is that almost everyone who is mentored goes on to mentor.
Yeah.
The only adequate way you can express gratitude for that gift is to pass it on. And when you do that, the person who gave you the gift, their gift is magnified. I have this idea that our smallest gestures ripple out farther than we can imagine. This is not, I didn't come up with that, but it's a concept that I really kind of embrace. And this is a perfect example of it. Rick Barrett, the poet, gave a deep read and thoughtful last lap edits to Su Huang, the poet, who, in gratitude for Rick's gift, gave me a deep read and last lap edits on my manuscript.
Mm.
I don't think Rick Barrett knows that.
Wow.
But when I talked to Su Huang about it, what Su tells me is, and I said, how can I repay you? How can I repay you? And she's like, don't worry about it. Rick Barrett did this kind thing for me.
Wow.
With the expectation of no reward.
Wow.
But okay. So my whole point is, that's the world I want to live in.
Yes. Yes. In this vein, you briefly mentioned work in so the in Minnesota prison writing workshop. Can you talk about what that is? Because I haven't researched it really, but what is that and how did you fall into that work and what have you just tell me about that.
So in Minnesota we have the Minnesota Prison Writing Workshop, and it is not unique in America, but not every state has one. And we are a collective of creative writers who offer mentorship and instruction to writers who live in correctional facilities. And in non-pandemic times, we go to one of the 7 adult correctional facilities in the state of Minnesota, and we teach creative writing classes. And we work with writers who are interested in fiction, creative nonfiction, poetry, just you name it, screenplays, songwriting. I first started teaching with MPWW about 5 years ago, and it changed my life. I taught my first class. It was a poetry class at Oak Park Heights, which is a maximum security prison near Stillwater, east of the Twin Cities. And it was probably the third week that I was doing it that I found myself just hoping that I would get to do it for a really long time. I benefit so much from time in conversation with other writers, with access to their ideas. And, you know, also I learned a lot trying to figure out how to say, here's how you can think about this concept.
Yeah.
Finding a way to share it that was portable and effective helped me understand it more profoundly than I did before I made that effort.
Yes. Yes. That is the gift of teaching. One of the many gifts, isn't it?
Yeah.
It always blows me away, you know, how like I learn so much more from my students, I think, sometimes than they learn from me. And just the way that I, you know, preparing things to tell them, it's like, oh, wow. You know, you look at things differently. And Yeah. Oh, thank you. That's amazing. Well, I have 2 more questions for you. And if you don't mind, I forgot to ask you this earlier, but after we wrap up with the questions, would you be willing to read a poem?
Sure.
Fabulous. Okay. So this one question I've been asking to everybody for a while is, and you may have already answered it, but what is an act of kindness that you've received in your life that really had a big impact on you?
Oh, that's such a good question. I mean, obviously the easy answer is Juliet's mentorship. But I'd love to kind of share something beyond that. You know, here's a story I would love to tell. There's a poet here in the Twin Cities who passed away recently. Her name is Ethna McKernan, and her friends called her Essie. And I met Ethna reading together, and just kind of in reading rooms in the Twin Cities, and she was just a beautiful poet, just so talented and so unpretentious in her being, a person of prodigious talent who never put on airs or she just really loved her art and wouldn't sully it with something like that. Mm. And I was reading with her once and she asked me if I was working on a book and I said yes, and she said, "Aim high."
Mm.
And the reason I bring that up is not as a way of saying anything other than that comment, and I could share a version of that comment in other settings, is probably my favorite kindness.
Mm.
I remember when I was in Juliet's poetry class at the Loft, and she said, "You know, I think you have something here," in response to a poem that I had written. I can think of other times when I've read something and a poet that I admired a lot took a moment to say, "I liked that," or "I appreciated this moment," or that type of thing. So for me, I think my favorite kindness is encouragement.
Oh.
I feel like we all need that. And probably the most important thing that I've learned teaching in correctional facilities is not the power of encouragement. It's how many people make it quite far in their life without really experiencing it.
Mm.
Mm. Wow. I mean, really experiencing it. Every once in a while, someone might say, "Hey, you're good at that," but to invest time and attention, to take a moment to say, "I see you, I hear you, what you've made here, what you've done here, it's on the way to something, keep going." That kindness and Ethna's words to me meant a lot to me. And I've been lucky in that people have from time to time in moments when I needed it said, hey, this is pretty cool. So that would have to be my favorite kindness.
Oof. You can't see me right now, but my eyes are filled with tears. that was so profound and just so beautiful and a needed reminder, you know, how, yes, we are small in this world, but we also can have a great impact on, you know, these small things. So, thank you.
Thank you.
Last question is, can you share a piece of art, whether that's a book or album, film, et cetera, that is important to you? That's a big question.
Okay. All right. Can I answer with three?
Of course.
Okay. Number one, in no particular order.
Okay.
There's a movie called The Living Need Light, The Dead Need Music.
Oh.
And it's by the Propeller Group. And they're an arts collective out of Ho Chi Minh City, Vietnam. And this is a film that I saw at the Minneapolis Institute of Arts, now called MIA. It's about 15 minutes long, and it's in the art house world of films that are on an endless loop as you walk through a museum.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Yeah. And it's about Eastern death rituals. It's about defying death. I almost don't have words to describe it, but that film, when it was showing at the Minneapolis Institute of Arts, was an absolute obsession, and I went to see it all the time. And as I started to worry that eventually it would not be there anymore, every time I would go to the library, up to the museum, I would walk in and I would say, hey, is that movie still showing? And do you know when it won't be showing again?
Wanted to make sure you got it.
Yeah. And if I was within 5 miles of the museum and I had 30 minutes, I would go. I'm prone to obsessions in general. And I don't know how many times I saw that, but I saw something new in it every time. It also, I was probably 50 when it was at the museum. And so it the death defying, the funeral rituals, all of it just really spoke to like this emerging sense of my mortality that tends to arrive at midlife. So that's one.
Yep. Okay. And also, can I just quickly say that I remember hearing you say that you're prone to obsessions, and I immediately felt a kinship with you because I too am prone to obsessions.
It's so bad.
So when you were saying that, I was like, I understand completely.
Yeah.
Oh, anyways, I'm sorry to interrupt. Go ahead.
The second one for me is probably the E.E. Cummings poem I Sing of Olaf Glad and Big.
I don't remember.
Yeah.
Okay.
It's the first poem that I read that I remember thinking, oh, wow. What is this?
Mm.
Every poem I read before then on assignment, as I was assigned this poem, I was kind of like, I mean, all right, fine. I'll write the paper and then I'm never doing this again. But I got to, I Sing of Olaf Glad and Big, whose warmest heart recoiled at war, a conscientious object door. And I was just like, wait.
Wow.
What's happening here?
Yeah.
And at some point on Twitter, one of my local buddies wrote, like, what was your gateway poem? And I always hoped it would be something like Those Winter Sundays.
Right.
Or, you know, like, I'm straight up, I really wished it would have been a Black poet. And I grew up with so much Langston Hughes in the house and so much Maya Angelou in the house. And I love those poets. But the first one that made me stop and go, I wait, what's happening? I have to understand this, was I Sing of Olaf Glad and Big, which is this profane, overtly political, extremely patriotic poem about a conscientious objector who just will not do what he's asked to do.
Wow.
And it's got a very complex metrical pattern. It's pretty specific in its syntax. And I think it's even set to 8 syllables per line. I know a lot of it. It just, I still to this day, I am almost embarrassed. I at least read it twice a year, at least.
Oh, that's amazing. So how, were you a kid when you read it first?
No, I was in college.
You're in college. Okay. Well, Norton, yeah, that's when it all starts, right?
Norton Anthology.
Oh, yes.
Yeah. We were most of the way through the semester, and I was like, I'm not gonna, poetry's not gonna catch on for me, but let's go ahead and finish up. And then I stumbled on this work, and I'm like, okay, I want to know more. I want to know more about poetry. And then the last one, it's so hard because I want to say a couple things, but I really, really love the Russian pianist Vladimir Horowitz.
Yeah. Oh, wow. And
I cannot explain why. I can't. I just, pretty much everything he ever did, I love it. But without question, probably my favorite album of all time is The Last Recording. Vladimir Horowitz, and he's at home recording with, you know, extremely impressive equipment that, you know, Sony people brought in, but he's playing the piano at home, and there's so much. He's still a virtuoso. There's so much wisdom and speed and power and grace and emotion in every single song. I'm exceedingly fond of him as an artist. He's among a number of artists that I could say that for, but my Desert Island album, and I can be a little shy about it, 'cause like, what's your Desert Island album, Michael? And I want to say Marvin Gaye, right? Or A Tribe Called Quest or something better, but if I'm just being real, The Last Recording by Vladimir Horowitz.
That's awesome.
Never, ever, ever get tired. Never. Wow. I don't know how many times I've heard it. I hear something new in it every time, just like that movie. And I love that
piece. The best kind of art does that to you, you know?
Yeah.
Oh, thank you. Okay. So if you would read a poem, I have so many of these dog-eared, and it would be hard for me to choose. I'll let you choose whatever you feel like.
Okay. All right.
Is that making it difficult on you?
I want to read the last poem.
Great. Great.
Every morning. And then it does have, I don't know how you feel about language on your podcast.
Oh, no. All language is fine.
All right.
Yeah.
Every morning. Walking my neighborhood, I come upon a colony of ants busy at work. I take care not to step on any and miss them all. Then encounter up a ways a fellow traveler greeting the day. I'm frightening her. No, she's afraid of me. Is she an introvert? Is she a neighbor? Is she just in from the burbs, from the country? Is she scared of the inner city? Am I the inner city? Is she racist? Shouldn't I be the wary one? Or is she a survivor? Like me. It can't be what I'm wearing. Khakis, a blue and white checkered button-down shirt, and the nylon sandals I favor because they're comfortable. My feet can breathe in them. Dear friends, I am the nicest man on earth. And I want to shout morning, but just then a weaver or carpenter, just then a pharaoh or fire or pavement, just then a little black ant struggles by, alone, alone. And in that moment, I want us to give ourselves over to industry, carry the weight of the day together, lighten it. I want to be part of a colony where I feel easy walking around, cool as the goddamn breeze, where I can breathe, build structures sturdier and grander than this. But the woman crosses to the other side of the street, and I do what I usually do. Retreat into myself as far as I can, then send out whatever's left.
Thank you so much, Michael, for your beautiful reading, for your beautiful soul, and for being on this podcast. This this conversation was such a gift. Thank you.
Well, thanks for having me. Thanks for the invitation. And I will hope for an in-person greeting.
Yes.
When we get a chance.
Absolutely.
So if you see me bopping around, just tap me on the shoulder.
Absolutely. And, you know, I hope to go to Minnesota at some point in the next year. So I will definitely send you a note when I come.
Listen, if you come to the Twin Cities without telling me, I'll find out. I will find out.
I promise. You and Krista are going to be the two people that I tell first.
All right. So, perfect. <send email. laughs>
Thank you. Thank you, Michael. Yeah, for everything you do.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah.
And thanks for your kindness.
Have a great day, and I'll talk to you soon.
You bet.
Bye.
Bye.
Musings of the Artist is audio produced by Aaron Morin, and theme music is by Madison Ward.